Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets, like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hey, I'm Grant Wall, and welcome to the Planet Football Podcast. This is our Women's World Cup podcast with me and Sports Illustrated's Lakin Littman. We'll be publishing podcast episodes after every U.S. game during the tournament. I'll also be interviewing Eniola Aluko, who's doing terrific work during this tournament for Fox Sports. While we've got you, make sure to check out our podcast series, Throwback, on the origin stories of the U.S. Women's National Team and the FIFA Women's World Cup. That's Throwback. Promise you won't regret it. Onward! All right, let's bring in Lakin Littman, USA 2, England 1, US in the World Cup final on the women's side for the third straight time. Lakin, how are you?
I'm good, Grant. How are you?
As I just mentioned to you before we started recording, I'm hungry, but more importantly than that, I'm excited to cover the final, USA against either Sweden or the Netherlands on Sunday. But let's talk about this game tonight. Tough, hard game for the U.S., and they end up pulling it out. Lisson Nair makes a huge penalty kick save late to keep it at 2-1. VAR helps out the U.S., after it looked like it was 2-2, but Ellen White was just offside. Were you pretty worried during these moments?
Yeah. I mean, it's like heading into this game, you know, it's like yesterday there's all the British tabloid fodder, and it's like it just kind of seems a little bit light. You know, it doesn't have the kind of anticipation that, you know, the USA-France quarterfinal had, and you know, Phil Neville's making the comments and all this stuff. And then, you know, first we find out Megan Rapinoe's not playing, and you're kind of like, wait, what? Like, now what's going to happen? But then you remember the U.S. is stacked with depth, and Kristen Press is filling in, and she scores, you know, within the first 10 minutes. And, you know, but then England quickly equalizes, and you're like, okay, well, this game's going to be for real. And it just turned into a game from there. I mean, Alex Morgan obviously scored what ended up being the decisive goal before halftime. But the second half was, I mean, that probably worried a lot of U.S. fans. I mean, as you said, like the goal that got called back and then Alyssa Nair, everyone's biggest question mark is the player of the game. Came through, had her shining moment of this World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I said about Alyssa Nair coming into this tournament was just because of the history of it all, this is the first World Cup the U.S. has had a goalkeeper other than Hope Solo or Brianna Scurry starting since 1991, which is kind of crazy to think about. And we simply didn't have an opportunity ever in a major tournament to see how Alyssa Nair would respond. And I guess one thing I sort of thought heading into the tournament was, she may also get the opportunity to really have a moment, to have a defining moment. And she got that tonight. And I think that's maybe the biggest story of the night, that Alyssa Nair made this huge penalty kick save. And yes, Steph Houghton didn't look confident taking it and didn't take a great penalty, but it still had to get saved. And to do it in that moment with just a few minutes left in the game, when the momentum was entirely with England at that point, as it had been for most of the second half, just a really impressive performance there by Alyssa Nair, who also made a very big stop on a shot right after the U.S. had made it 2-1.
Yeah, and that goal, I mean, that shot was, I mean, that could have been one of the best, had it gone in, one of the best goals of the tournament. That was a rocket.
Yeah. And so for Nair to come up that big, that's just such a huge moment for her. And you saw at the end of the game when the whistle blew, the U.S. players all ran toward Nair. So, like, they can say what they want about how they haven't, we haven't noticed questions about Alyssa Nair. Of course they've noticed. That's why they ran out the way they did. But it's pretty cool to see a player come up so big like that in a truly defining moment of a World Cup. You mentioned Rapinoe not starting. She did tell us after the game she had a mild hamstring strain that happened late in the France game. She expects to be ready for Sunday's final, and she'll have 4 full off days now to rest up and get ready for that. Rose Lavelle said that even though she appeared to have a hamstring issue that brought her out of this game, which I thought she played very well, by the way, that she would be fine and ready for Sunday as well. So, you know, for the first time in this tournament, the U.S. is finally going to have a chance to have more rest than its opponent will in the next game, because that hasn't happened at all in any of the previous games. What did you think in terms of Alex Morgan tonight getting back on the scoring sheet for the first time since game one against Thailand and doing it with what ended up being the game-winning goal?
Yeah, I thought it was funny that she did this on her 30th birthday. They asked her, I saw on the Fox broadcast, like, how does this compare to other birthdays? And she just laughed and was like, it's a pretty good birthday, I'd say. But yeah, I mean, she has to feel relieved in some way, right? Like, she was on a 4-game scoring drought, and to come through in the semifinal and score the game-winning goal, really, you know, she just hadn't really looked, we had talked about, she hadn't really looked right the last few games. I mean, she played well, obviously, against France, and she set up both of the goals that propelled the U.S. to beat France, of course. But, you know, she didn't play against Chile, got knocked around against Sweden. She was pretty much on the ground, like, the whole game against Spain, and was clearly very frustrated. And, you know, when you have these individual goals, at least, to come into the World Cup and play your best and score however many goals, and you're not doing that, it's got to be frustrating. So, you know, heading into the final now, she's got a ton of momentum and confidence going. And, you know, she also had to step up with Rapinoe out, I felt like, and act like the star that, you know, that she, you know, is. So I thought that she did all the things that she needed to do. And the way that she scored, that whole play, the way that it manifested was, it was like, it was perfect, I thought.
I really liked both of the U.S. goals tonight, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, just a lot of the little things. So, like, the dummy that Lavelle had on the first goal that sent the ball clean through to Kelly O'Hara, who hit just a perfect cross to Press for that header. I haven't seen Kristen Press score too many goals with her head in the past, by the way. And then the second goal, just, I think Abby Dahlkemper gets, like, no credit at all, but she sent a terrific diagonal ball that she's very good at, and she's done a few times in this tournament, to Press, who then hits a short pass to Horan, who then just sort of looks up and sees Morgan making a run. I just thought both of those goals were tremendously well executed.
Yeah, I agree. And Press is just her receiving the long ball from Dahlkemper. That control was just impressive. I mean, when you have a player closing on you and then she gets it to her hand quickly, it was just all set up so perfectly.
Yeah. I mean, after the game tonight, I asked Kristen Press about what scoring this goal meant. And then I had noted that she, after she had scored, looked up to the sky. And if you follow Kristen Press on social media, it appeared that she had lost someone close to her somewhat recently. And I asked her, and she said she actually lost her mom recently, which she was extremely emotional to have that. And I felt kind of, in a way, bad for bringing it up, but not totally, because it's something that was important to her and I think has been driving her in this tournament. But she was terrific tonight, and you know, she hasn't always been known as a big game player, but she really produced in a very, very big game for the U.S. And I think all of us know what Kristen Press is capable of when she's in form, and I've always sort of been waiting to see it in a World Cup or an Olympics, and we saw that tonight. So, you know, credit to her.
Yeah, agree. It's like when Rapinoe goes out and everyone, at least on Twitter, you could see is freaking out. It's like, oh, well, Kristen Press is coming in. Well, what do we know about Kristen Press? It's like, anytime she plays, it feels like she's scoring, making plays. So she came through and came up big tonight.
Yeah. You know, in the end here, I think this was a deserved result, but very, very close at times, you know, when you see it go 2-2 on the scoreboard, and we hadn't seen VAR much in recent games in this tournament, and then we do see it here. Then we see VAR again on this penalty on Sauerbrunn, who some people were asking if she should have gotten a red card because they didn't think she was playing the ball. I still don't know if that was clear and obvious to merit VAR coming back in, but the phrase we always hear on these types of situations when the penalty then gets saved is ball don't lie.
Yes.
Ball don't lie in this one. Anything else about this U.S. team, this performance tonight, England, that sticks out to you?
I would say it's just another example of how we've talked so much about the U.S. depth and like joke that it's two starting lineups in one roster. And this was just the exact example of that actually coming to fruition, using players that don't start as often and coming in and being a reason why they won. And now, I mean, because of people, players like Press and Horan and, I mean, Lavella started every game, but she's still kind of an unknown commodity to a lot of people. And Nair obviously starting in her first World Cup, and then players coming off the bench. I mean, now the U.S. is going to another World Cup final.
It's pretty impressive. The U.S. did win, which team would you rather play in the final? Would you prefer to see the Netherlands or Sweden?
I'm kind of torn here because I would really like to see the matchup against the Netherlands. They've been just an exciting team to watch with Leke Martens and Miedema, and to see them go against the U.S. back line I think would be really fun. On the other hand, you know, when the U.S. played Sweden, Sweden was kind of just, you know, sitting that one out. They were like, we're through to the knockout stage. They didn't play all of their starters. Obviously,
cowards.
Yeah. Hello, cowards. Hope Solo is going to be there if they play again. Just given the rich history. And it's like, I almost feel like if it's U.S.-Sweden again, that would be even more of a revenge game from the Olympics because they have like their full roster available. So I don't know, maybe the U.S. wants to play Sweden.
Well, I'm kind of bummed out that Nilla Fischer didn't start for Sweden in the last game against the U.S. She's actually one of my favorite players in women's soccer just because she is like the toughest player in women's soccer. But yeah, they didn't have seven starters in that game against the U.S. I still would prefer to see the Netherlands. I think they're a really interesting, fun team that has really risen in the last few years from just making its first World Cup in 2015 to winning the Euro in 2017 to now being in a position to win the World Cup in 2019. And they haven't gotten perfect performances out of even their front three. I think Van de Sanden's a good player typically, but she's been sort of poor in this tournament. But Miedema and Martens have had their moments. And I just would love to see two 4-3-3 teams, attacking teams, going after each other in the final. And I love the Dutch brass band that travels with
them. Oh, the fan base is one of the best. So, yes. If we're talking purely about that, then let's get the Netherlands and the American Outlaws against each other.
So, interesting thing tonight, there was sort of a subplot. You had Ellen White getting to a tournament leading six goals, and then you had Alex Morgan getting to six goals right after that. White gets to seven for a few seconds. That gets wiped off the board. Who do you think is going to win the Golden Boot? Who do you think is the tournament's best player right now?
Well, I think now with the momentum that we were talking about earlier, Alex Morgan scores one more goal in the final, she wins the Golden Boot. And that's who we, I think, both predicted to win it before the tournament even began. But the player of the tournament, I was thinking about it before this game, and I was like, oh, well, obviously it's Megan Rapinoe, but then she didn't play in this game. But I still don't think you can discount everything that she's done leading up to where putting the U.S. in position to where it is now. I mean, scoring, she has 5 goals, and we were joking that, oh, she could be in contention for the Golden Boot. I mean, those two goals against Spain, 2 goals against France, the whole the whole thing with Trump, not back and forth, but the whole Twitter debacle with President Trump. You know, she's just risen to the occasion every single time that, you know, there's been a challenge. She's answered it. I think even without playing in this game, we could still maybe make the argument for her. There's no way she's going to miss the final, so we'll see how she plays in that game. But then it was like, I was like, well, can I say Alyssa Nair? Because without her, the U.S. wouldn't even be going maybe to the final. But no, I won't go that far. But I don't know. I feel like overall, Rapinoe has made the biggest difference.
Yeah, I think it should depend on who wins the tournament. If the U.S. wins, I think, based on where we are right now, Megan Rapinoe would still be that choice, though it could be very dependent on who stands out in the final.
True.
I do think Alex Morgan's probably going to end up winning the Golden Boot here, though Miedema could go crazy in the semi and the final. Who knows? I'm looking forward to, you know, this one last semifinal and then one last final. It should be a fun few days here. Let's see if we have any other questions. Oh, yes. In other news, how do we feel about France and Germany missing the Olympics next year?
Yeah, that is a horrible process. I mean, like, how could two of the top 5 teams in the world not be going to the Olympics based on, you know, chance at from the Women's World Cup? I mean, they should expand the field so that this kind of thing doesn't happen in the future. Just, I mean, to not have those two
really
global powers.
So, like, very quick background on this is the Olympic women's soccer tournament obviously is next year in Japan. The top 3 European teams from the World Cup get automatic berths in the Olympics the following year. And that's simply based on how far do you go in the World Cup. And it doesn't really take into account the draw, which was really unfortunate for France. They drew the U.S. in the quarterfinals. And so France is out of the World Cup or the Olympics for next year. Germany is out after losing to Sweden. And the 3 European teams that will be in the Olympics are Great Britain, Sweden, and the Netherlands. And there's 2 big problems here. One, that the IOC needs to start having more than 12 women's teams in the tournament, at least 16 like the men's do, but the men's Olympic tournament's kind of not taken that seriously anyway. I wouldn't have an issue if it was a 24-team tournament for the women and 16 for the men, because at least with the women, you get the best players in the world.
Right.
And then I think it's also an issue that UEFA decides not to have some sort of qualifying situation tournament-wise for determining who advances to the Olympics. And all these people at UEFA say, oh, well, we have full qualifying campaigns for the World Cup and the Euro, and therefore we don't have time to play an Olympic qualifying tournament. But they could take merely the teams, the European teams that made it to the Women's World Cup this time, and have like a really short tournament that could take like a really short amount of time, and they could figure out their entrance in a much fairer way that would make for a better Olympic tournament.
I am less excited
about next year's Olympics now that France and Germany won't be there.
That's a great idea. Yeah. I mean, like, that's just, they want people to watch the Olympics, I imagine.
Right.
Like, I mean, you're kind of steering people away from it. It's like, do I really want to watch the U.S. play Sweden again? I mean, it's just, you'd rather see those global powers in there. So they need to make a change.
Yeah. So last question for you. What are you interested to see about what happens in the coming days with the U.S. team ahead of the final?
I'm sorry, repeat that.
What are you interested in seeing, like, what's most on your mind in the next few days with the U.S. team leading into the final?
Well, I mean, I don't have any qualms about their togetherness. I mean, they're going to be there. They've been in this bubble this whole entire World Cup, and it's just like you have this one more game left mentality. And Jill Ellis said something after the game along those lines, like, that was great, but, you know, do it again on Sunday. Obviously, like, just stay humble, which I feel like this team will. But I don't know if you read the Sue Bird Players Tribune piece. Yes. She wrote, which was really great, about Megan Rapinoe, and she shared like a fun anecdote at the end about something that Megan did at halftime of the 2015 World Cup final when they're up 4-1. You know, they end up crushing Japan, but while everyone's serious, she comes out and says, like, we're gonna win the World Cup. So I guess I'm kind of interested, is this team gonna allow themselves to, I mean, they're going to be serious, but are they going to allow themselves to have a little bit of fun, you know, be a little bit not relaxed, but kind of like that kind of Rapinoe mindset a little bit, especially since she is, you know, the true heart and soul of this team. Whereas, you know, 4 years ago, it was more Abby Wambach and Carly Lloyd leading the charge. So I guess kind of like how they approach that. They seem like a really fun loving group that, you know, is very into that 23 mentality, but are they also going to let, you know, not let the moment escape them and enjoy it and have fun with it?
Yeah, I think they will. I mean, like, I think they found a good balance in this tournament of taking their opponents seriously, but also like having some fun with their goal celebrations. Alex Morgan did tonight with her little tea ceremony after scoring against England, which I thought was great. So I think they'll be ready for that. I think it's pretty incredible that this is the third straight Women's World Cup final for the U.S. You never know if you'll be in a final like this in your entire career. And so for some of these players, it's their third. But they also know from 2011 that just because they're going to be favored doesn't mean they're going to win. And I think they're going to come out with a real attitude to score early, like they did, like they've done in every single game of this tournament, but also like they did in the 2015 final against Japan.
Yeah, that stat with the U.S. has scored in the first 12 minutes of every single game this World Cup is, I mean, not surprising when you think about it, but also like, whoa, that's fast. They get off to these.
It's just it's just absolutely ruthless, and it's one thing to do against Thailand. It's another thing to do against top teams like France and England. So
yes.
Looking forward to it, and always a pleasure to speak to you, Lakin.
You too, Grant. Thanks.
Big thanks to Lakin Littman. Next up is my interview with Eniola Aluko of Fox Sports. Our guest today is Eniola Aluko, who has played in 3 World Cups for England, currently plays for Juventus, and is doing terrific work for Fox Sports during the Women's World Cup. She also has a memoir coming out called They Don't Teach This, Lessons from the Game of Life. That comes out August 29th. Eni, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Grant. Thank you for having me.
It has been an absolute pleasure getting to know you a little bit during this tournament and work with you. We are recording this on the Sunday before the USA-England semifinal, and unfortunately this is coming out after that game. So instead of breaking down the matchups, what I want to ask you about England is, how did England take the next step forward, upward in the women's game over the past 5 years to become truly one of the world's elite teams?
I think the Olympics was a big kickstarter for for the game in England. I think that prior to that, there was a lot of semi-professional teams that were sort of paying it lip service, if you like, that weren't taking the game seriously. Certainly from a Chelsea perspective, I mean, we didn't have a professional setup per se. We were training at the training ground, but we were training it in the evening at 8 o'clock at night on the AstroTurf. If we were lucky, we had the whole AstroTurf. Sometimes we had half the AstroTurf. Oh, wow. We didn't have water bottles. It wasn't something that was taken seriously. After the Olympics, I think all the major teams had a eureka moment and thought, well, hold on a second, there's something in this. If we invest in the women's game, it's a win from a public relations perspective, and then we can also engage with a wider fan base. And it became a trend. And as you can see, just in this tournament, when there's major investment in the professional structure of women's football, it helps the national teams. And that's pretty much the story across Europe. And that's been the story for England. It's been steady investment since from the FA, but also from clubs, since 2012, which has culminated in now having a team of fully fledged professionals who can call football their only job or their main job.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we're benefiting from sort of a long-term vision from the Football Association to have a professional league. I think the Football Association deserves credit for sort of putting criteria in place for saying, if you want to come into our league, you got to have certain requirements. And I respect that, because after playing in the WPS,
mm-hmm.
Tons of money from owners, but not a lot of structure and commitment.
Okay, interesting. What has Phil Neville done, in your opinion, to take things forward for England even more? Because people were sort of skeptical when he was hired.
Yeah, very skeptical. I think people almost felt like he skipped the queue a little bit.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there was female managers who sort of put their work in for a long time and who deserved the job. I wasn't one of the people that thought that it should be a man or a woman. I think it should be the best person for the job. I don't think it should be gender specific at all, but I do understand the skepticism around him not having any women's football experience.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also not a reason to give someone the job, because I think what you have seen is that he's very committed to, you know, understanding the women's game, understanding what players need. I know he studied the US team and the mentality, so, you know, I think he's been humble enough to understand that that's what it's going to take. It's you can't just rock up as Phil Neville and expect it to happen overnight. I think the main thing for me, obviously being in the team in 2015 under Mark Sampson, is he's completely changed the style of play. The style of play wasn't suited to the players.
Hmm.
Back in 2015, yes, we got to the semi-final, but it was a very ugly way of playing, in my opinion. It was very, you know, front to back, possession football. There wasn't a lot of trust in the players' ability. There was a lot of panic in the way we played, a lot of sort of beating other teams up physically. But that can only get you so far. I think Phil Neville has utilised the fact that he has top players in his team, Manchester City players, Arsenal players, Chelsea players, who week in, week out play a brand of football that is possession orientated, that is counter-attack orientated. So he's done that very quickly, and you can see now that, you know, England are dominating games in possession. I think Tuesday is going to be the key test.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to be, okay, you know, England are in the semi-final. Everyone expected them to be. That was the minimum expectation, mm-hmm. to be honest. So I don't think there's lots of cause for celebration. I think if they beat the US, that's when we're talking.
For you, covering this World Cup, you've done terrific work on Fox.
Thank you so much.
Is it still a little weird not to be playing in a World Cup? Because you've played in the last three, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I'm only 32, and, you know, I'm seeing players playing who are a lot older than me. But my story is different. You know, I stopped playing for the national team for reasons that weren't football specific, and
is there a short version? Because I know some of our listeners aren't going to be aware of that.
So basically, I was playing in the national team up until 2016, and I was asked to be part of a sort of a confidential review for the national team, and I basically, for want of a better term, blew the whistle on the manager and a lot of things that I felt were happening in the team that weren't acceptable, including sort of racist comments made to me and other players. And long story short, that confidential report then got leaked to the press, and it was just a whole big story. And Since then, I haven't played for the national team. So I think people can make of that what they will. But that's my story, and that's kind of... That's the last time I played for the national team was 6 weeks before I was part of that confidential review. So that's the facts. I mean, still to this day, I don't really know why, but ultimately, I think the most important thing is that I've moved on, and I'm very content with my career in the national team. I have 102 caps, which a lot of players don't get to say they have. And I love my job. I love working with Fox. I love commentating and analyzing the game and giving my nuggets on personal experiences and experiences with players. You know, I feel very blessed to be doing that too. So it's, you know, it's a glass full kind of approach.
Yeah. Is doing work in U.S. television, in what ways is it similar and different from U.K. television?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that over the past sort of few weeks. Like, what are the differences? I think with Fox, it's very structured. So pre-production meetings are sort of an hour long, and you have set topics on what you're going to talk about, and then everybody decides, okay, you hit this point, another pundit will hit another point. And so you know pretty much what you're going to say. You know what everyone else is going to say. You can bounce off other pundits, and I really like that structure. And there's a lot of input from the analysts about what to talk about. So for example, we had a situation a few days ago where one of the producers asked, you know, is it important, rest, you know, is rest important at this point of the tournament? And you know, me and Heather O'Reilly, you know, who obviously two-time World Cup winner for USA, said, well, actually adrenaline probably kicks in at this point. And then we scrapped that conversation. And so we're able to sort of have an input and guide the conversation. Whereas back home in England, it's very much producer-led. The producers set the topics and you decide what to say, but there's no real influence on what the topics are gonna be.
Interesting.
And then on top of that, when you're actually on the show live, it's very much based on, you know, presenters kind of throwing questions to you. You may not know what that question's going to be. Whereas at Fox, I always kind of know when Rob Stone's coming to me. So it's just different. And there's no right or wrong. For me, it's just an additional experience that I can add to my punditry experience.
I didn't know until right before we started recording here that you have a book coming out, a memoir.
Yes, I do, yeah.
And I'm excited to read it. What's in it? How was the experience?
So the book is called They Don't Teach This, which is basically, the book is about the lessons in life that you learn only through going through experiences. You can't learn it. There's no manual to life, right? You've got to kind of figure it out as you go along. You have to try and take lessons from the very bad experiences and the very good experiences. And that's part of the blessing of life. Like, we're students of life and we kind of have to just keep learning. It's also a bit of a play on sort of the idea of me as an educated footballer. You know, this, I went to law school and all that kind of stuff, and people know me for that reason. And, you know, it's the idea that, well, no one taught me a lot of the stuff I'm talking about in this book. Like, I had to figure it out myself. And I think that's the experience of many, many people. Just being able to make mistakes, fail, succeed, and sort of grow in that way. So the book is about, it's obviously about football, the lessons I've taken from football, but it's also about the lessons I've taken from life. It touches on... identity, you know, me as a British Nigerian football player and all the sort of issues I had growing up, not really fitting into either, not necessarily fitting into British, you know, what Britishness means, and not necessarily being able to relate to Nigerian, being Nigerian either. And sort of that whole identity journey. it touches on gender equality and the journey I've been on to now and seeing how the women's game has grown. It celebrates failure, it celebrates success. It's a real kind of all-encompassing book that I think transcends football, to be honest.
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, so it comes out, you can pre-order it now on Amazon.
Oh, okay.
But it's published, it will come out officially August 29th. So
okay.
I'm very excited about it.
Congratulations. you have been playing in Italy.
Yes.
And I've been surprised as much as anything in this tournament by Italy's success.
Yes, me too, yeah.
And so I'm curious to know, so based on sort of my study of the history of the women's game, Italian women's soccer, they had a professional league for women in the late 60s. It was one
really?
Of the first ones.
Wow.
They even allowed women to play. I don't know if everyone was professional, but there were some professionals in that league in the 60s. In the 80s, before there even was a FIFA Women's World Cup, Italy hosted four, they called them Mundialitos, which were unofficial World Cups. But there was an interest, clearly, in Italy in the women's game. When the U.S. women's national team played in its first tournament ever, it was in that Mundialito in Italy. You had players like Carolina Maracchi, mm-hmm. who were legendary. But then it's crazy to me that it went 20 years past, from 99 to 2019, for Italy to even make a Women's World Cup.
Right.
And here they are now getting to the quarterfinals. What happened?
I think it goes back to what I said earlier about the exponential growth that comes with investment in women's football. I'm not surprised because I see the investment from a Juventus point of standpoint. I see what Fiorentina are doing. I see what AC Milan are doing. Inter Milan are going to come in this year into the game. Hmm. Roma are going to come in. These are all institutions in Italy, footballing institutions. I grew up watching Serie A, watched these clubs, and a lot of English male players were playing in Italy when I was growing up because it was the best league in the world, and they were playing for these clubs. So ultimately, you have fan bases that go back centuries that are now able to access women's football. You have players that have grown up wanting to play for these clubs that are now professionals in these clubs. So when you get to the national team, it's no longer daunting playing in front of 45,000 people because you've done it.
Mm-hmm.
In your league, we sold out Allianz Stadium, 39,000 people playing against Fiorentina because it was Juventus Fiorentina. That's what fans wanted to see.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like the professionalism of the game and the investment in Italy has made, has just benefited the players and has just created a different mentality for the players when they put on an Italian shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the case all over Europe. I think that's why you're seeing pretty much the European Championships versus the USA right now, because that's where all the money is, that's where all the investment is.
How much longer do you want to keep playing?
Oh, that's a sensitive question.
Sorry.
honestly, I feel very full right now in terms of my footballing career. I feel like I've pretty much achieved everything that I set out to achieve. Aside from winning the World Cup and, the Champions League, I've won everything. For a big club at Chelsea, I've won individual awards, Player of the Year. I'm playing in Italy now. I'm learning a new language. I've just won the league with Italy and won the double again. So there's not much left to do. There's not much left to do, quite honestly. And as I said, I've sort of let go of my international career in a way. So I don't think it's going to be long.
Okay.
I think because I'm a firm believer that you should always let go when you've still got a little bit left in the tank. But you shouldn't just play for the sake of playing. I mean, a lot of people say to me, "Yeah, but you don't get that opportunity back to play," and that's right. But I also think, if you're just playing and going through the motions, you're stopping somebody else who's got loads of years ahead of them, having their career to play for.
Right.
So, the answer to the question is I don't know, but I think it's soon.
Okay, gotcha.
in the next 2 years.
In terms of, you've got a lot of options, I would think, post-playing career. Yeah. If you've got a law degree, I think you could do television, as you've shown. I don't know if you have an interest in coaching. What do you want to do?
Well, my interest is kind of more in the administrative side. Mm-hmm. So becoming a sporting director or a technical director.
Mm-hmm.
I just finished my UEFA Masters for international players to kind of learn the ropes on that stuff, on mm-hmm. how to kind of, you know, set a strategy for a club and manage managers and manage players and all that kind of recruitment and all that kind of stuff. So that was really super helpful because that gave me a network to tap into. I've also got a legal background, which I think will help the sporting director role.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the media. So, mm-hmm. and I've been doing that for a while now. I've been doing media for about 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I deliberately kind of, I've set myself up so that I can transition. The transition won't feel like, won't feel too daunting. I think a lot of players need to do more of that. Like, invest in your future career so that when it comes to you stopping playing, it's not going to be as terrifying. It will always be a bit terrifying, but it's not going to be as terrifying. So, I think, honestly, I'm a firm believer that you can do it all.
Yeah.
If you're allowed to do it all, you can do it all. So, hopefully, sporting director, media analyst, and, you know, a bit of law. I don't know. Maybe.
Fantastic. Well, Aniola Luco, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Grant. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Plant Football Podcast. I'd like to thank Lakin Littman and Aniola Luco, as well as producer Brandon Nix and everyone at Sports Illustrated who supports this podcast. Remember, check out Throwback, my podcast series on the origins of the U.S. Women's National Team and the FIFA Women's World Cup. See you next time.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Breaking news coming in from Bet365, and it's no surprise. Same game parlay from Bet365 just keeps getting better.
Well, it's even easier to make a bet. Choose from the most popular markets like hits, run line, totals, and home runs. So many to choose from.
Download the app, start building your bet, and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.